Doom Patrol, Negative Man, Elastigirl, Robot Man.
Someone wants the Doom Patrol reunited.
Your every word and action
is being broadcast across the planet.
Now, Monsieur Mana!
Well done, my Doom Patrol. Well done.
It is too late for you, Calder. Your beloved patrol is doomed.
Hello, and welcome to Waiting for Doom, the podcast where we obsess over how long it will be before the mighty Doom Patrol get their own comic again.
We may talk about other comic stuff. Just depends on our mood, frankly.
Yes. So I'm Mike, and you can find me on Twitter at AvantGarve, and you can also find our sentient show account, Wilfred, who's on Twitter, which is at WFDPod, and you can email us at waitingfordoom@gmail.com.
I'm Paul, and you can find me on Twitter at reading_Hicks, H-I-X. And you can also find us on Facebook, and all our many, many episodes are available on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, and podbean.com.
All 10 of them by the time we get this one done. Wow.
That's crazy. Double figures.
Double figures, Paul. Well done, bro. Well done.
We must be the first podcast to ever do that.
This week, we're heading back into the weird zone for Doom Patrol Volume 2 with issues 23 to 25, our second visit to Grant Morrison's take on the team. After that, we'll check the mailbag of Doom for your responses to our question of the week, which was, what's the most unsettling comic you've read? But first off, Paul, how was your week in comics and stuff?
I just got done with the reading Superman Unchained.
Ooh, the limited series that wasn't really a limited series, but they said was a limited series.
Well, this is where it's worth being a trade waiter, because I didn't get any of the frustrations of waiting for the last issue to come out over the many months it took. Did you read that one?
It did not go past the first issue test for me.
Oh, the Garve first issue test. Yep. Into the garbage.
Yeah, into the garbage with it. Something about the giant fold-out poster thing in the first issue, and just, I don't know, it just... I'm not that much of a Superman fan to begin with anyway, so I was like, I'll check it out. And then I didn't go any further.
The fold-out issue was the fold-out pages that you had to damage to open. That really annoyed some people. Heard some anger on that one. Well, I got it from the library, and it's a nice oversized hardcover, and it's quite a good read, actually. It's by Scott Snyder. He's a smart man. He says a lot of stuff that I would never think of, and, you know, he's learned. He knows lots of interesting things, and he puts them in the comic.
Okay.
And the art is by Jim Lee, new up-and-coming guy. One to watch, I think.
Right. Good.
Yeah. But, I mean, it's the first issue is not the best, but it does settle in and get some really good stuff. There is a classic Lex Luthor bit in it, which I reckon I'd be very happy if that came up in a movie in the future.
Okay.
Where basically Lex is in the Supermax prison, and he's been tasked to build something for the government. And halfway through the process, they realize that he's actually playing them, and they say, okay, it doesn't matter. We're just going to gas you, and you're going to lose all – you're going to be paralyzed, and, you know, you won't know what's going on, and then we'll just get you – you know, we'll come in and get you.
Mm-hmm.
And so they gas him and go in there, and Lex is basically grimacing and sweating with his eyes boggling, strapped into this suit that does all the walking and talking for him, and he's pre-recorded all this stuff that he's going to say as he escapes and beats everyone up, and it's just a great Lex Luthor moment.
Wow.
Where his body is completely incapacitated, but he's prepped for it, and you know, his exoskeleton just walks straight out of there, bashing everyone on the way.
I was just about to say, is it an exoskeleton or a Lexoskeleton?
Mike.
I'm on fire tonight.
Oh, just the witty ep from Mike. So I enjoyed it. I mean, I think it tries very hard to say some new things about Superman that no one has ever said before.
Okay.
And I think that probably is slightly to the detriment of the story.
Ooh.
But full marks for trying. And, quite a good book. I'm actually, you know, kind of wishing I'd bought that one. Anyway, What about you, Mike?
Yeah. Last week was good for comics. Some interesting things like Curb Stomp came out, which is kind of like a girl gang defending their turf in this American city. There was also the first print edition came out for a comic called, well, it's pronounced Dave, but it's spelled D with the numeral 4 VE, about a robot, basically all of Earth taken over by robots. They came, they wiped out humanity, they went and wiped out everything else in the galaxy. Then they kind of got bored. They kind of won the war and then thought, we kind of need to do proper boring adult stuff now. So Dave is a robot basically having a midlife crisis. He hates his job, you know, he's not getting along with his wife. He's got a teenage son that's turned up that apparently he ordered months ago and he now has to sort of interact with.
It sounds like that's a metaphor.
Possibly.
Metaphorical comic, anyway.
Yes. There was also Prince Valiant came out from the new King imprint line from Dynamite Comics. So that means all of the first issues of that King series are out now. And I'm quite enjoying that. That's some good old, you know, pulp adventure stuff going on there.
Yeah, you're into those, aren't you?
Yeah, it's quite good.
A Phantom and a bit of Mandrake.
Yeah. Mandrake was probably the only one out of those that I wasn't completely sold on because Mandrake kept looking so young.
Yeah.
He's meant to be this kind of... I've always pictured Mandrake being in, I don't know, his mid to late 40s. This kind of wise-ish character who's been around for a while and seen lots of different stuff. But he looked really young in this. So nothing against young people. It's just, I don't know.
You could gender swap Mandrake and make him Lady Drake.
You could. Right, yeah, okay, yep. Now you're being witty.
It's a witty ep.
The witty ep 10.
Witticisms everywhere.
Episode 10, they finally got their wits about them.
Say.
There was also issue 8 of Wicked and Divine, which I really, really, really enjoyed to the point that I did a fan video of it and put that up on YouTube, and lots of people have looked at it and given me good feedback and stuff and felt a little bit popular for a minute there.
Well done, Mike. Yes, I've heard of your video and the acclaim and lauding
Even Kieran Gillen, the writer of Wicked and Divine, quite enjoyed it and shared it with his followers on Tumblr. So I was like,
nice.
It was a bit of all right. Now I will have to do one for, I guess, our show.
Yeah.
I think so.
Yeah. Well, we don't have to, but that'd be good.
It would be nice, is what you're telling me.
Yeah. And Lord knows I'm not going to do it.
Yes, well, with all my copious free time and mad skills with a Z, I'll see what I can whip up and get some publicity out for our little show here.
Uh-huh. So, excellent. Yes. Good start. Oh, ticking.
That can only be the Doom Clock. I don't know why I'm laughing at the Doom Clock.
It just surprises us every week.
Yes, so let's have a look at the Doom Clock. And the numbers on the Doom Clock are telling me that the last book that our favourite team appeared in was Volume 5, issue number 22, which came out back in July of 2011. And so it's telling me that was 3 years and 7 months ago that book came out.
That's a lifetime ago.
Pretty much, you know, yeah. There are children that have been born since that time, you know?
Yeah, the world's changed since then.
And their last appearance of the Doom Patrol was back in Justice League 33, and that was almost 5 months ago now, back in October of 2014. So the passage of time, it's getting to us.
It's relentless.
It is. Time keeps on ticking into the future. As the young kids say. And then
flowing like a river to the sea.
Yeah, yes. And this week, back in 1994, we actually had Doom Patrol number 77 come out, which was in the Rachel Pollack era. And it went on sale for the princely sum of $1.95 American. Those were the days.
Well, that was pricey back then, I believe.
Probably. Yeah. It was a Vertigo book. They were a little bit, you know, out there. Yeah. This issue was part 3 of the 5-part Tiresias Wars. I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly. I'm sure someone will let us know if not. Cliff Steele got a new body again.
I believe it's pronounced Giacomo.
I think it was the Giacomo Wars. And the Doom Patrol were learning the origin of the Tiresias Wars, and they were under siege by a group called the Builders, and they discovered this group was trying to recreate the Tower of Babel. So lots of wacky shenanigans going on there. And interesting also to note that this was pretty much the beginning of the end for that run of the Doom Patrol, because they ended 10 issues later. So
wow.
Tiresias Wars was the second last story arc for 80s Doom Patrol.
Gosh.
Time passes, doesn't it? Just
does.
Shocking.
Every second.
Even now.
Even now. Time's passed.
It is. And that's it for the Doom Clock this week. Okay, so in Doomsplaining this week, we are returning again to Grant Morrison's vision of the team, looking at issues 23 to 25. Issue 23 came out in June of 1989, and the issue was called The Butterfly Collector, who is a mysterious character who ends up kidnapping Rhea, aka Lodestone, while she's comatose. And the big question is, who is he, where's he come from, and what does he want from our beloved Doom Patrol?
And where's his neck?
This is true. He does not have a neck.
It's a very, it's a real thing in this run that there's lots of characters whose heads are sort of just disembodied above their their torsos. And like this guy, his face is, it's sort of, what would you call it? Kabuki mask or picture
almost,
card
yeah,
mask?
Almost, yeah. Very similar to a kabuki mask, but I'm not sure if it's white with the black lines drawn on or whether it's just meant to be the shade of the mask as it walks around.
And he has, you know, frilly cuffs and collars, and he's a bit of a dandy-looking dude.
Just a bit, yes.
And he wears, it's a bit sort of French footwear. Aristocratic footwear. Mm. It's very aristocratic. Is probably a good word for.
Well, he is rather full of himself.
Yes.
Because of who he believes himself to be.
Yes. Yes, he names himself. Well, we'll get to this in a minute. But yes, it opens with him finding a butterfly on the floor, and you just get a. You don't get a good look at him at this point, but there's a butterfly, and it's got a damaged wing, and it's obviously in pain. And he said, "Do you dream of an end to the pain? There is no way out. There is no end, especially not today." And then you see that he's in a sprawling corridor, a very French chateau castle type. Mm. Yeah. Versailles Palace-looking place, but it's filled with cabinets of butterflies pinned up, all in pain.
Which is, I guess, you know, suitable for an issue called The Butterfly Collector.
Yeah.
But yes, so then we abruptly cut from his bizarre-looking palace, and we're back, I guess, in the real world, and we're catching up with Niles, the chief, and Joshua, and Dorothy. Spinner makes her appearance, and it's kind of the team is settling into their new headquarters on Rhode Island after dealing with the Scissormen in the first story arc of this new team. Which I found kind of interesting, the fact that it's kind of the calm after the storm.
Yeah, they're collecting themselves and, yeah. And Chief is lecturing Joshua about chaos theory and the principle that a cyclone in Bangladesh can be traced back to something as simple as the tiny perturbations made in the air by the wing of a butterfly in South America.
Lots of butterfly mentioned in this issue.
Yeah. Yeah. And then they greet Dorothy, who's he's met the team before in Paul Kupperberg's run, but never actually joined at that point.
And up until now, yeah.
Yeah, she's the apes-faced girl.
Poor thing.
Yeah.
I think there's a couple of themes going through this, and that there's mention of butterflies and chaos theory. And I think the next scene that we're shown really exemplifies the whole chaotic nature of this book, where we're then shown Rebus, who was Larry Traynor, aka Negative Man, and his attending physician, Eleanor Poole, and they're now the one mixed gender bandage being. And he/she is having a chat with Eleanor's husband. Well, not so much a chat as him losing his mind about it all, really.
It's a very awkward visit.
just a little bit.
When a bandaged hermaphrodite turns up at your house and says they used to be your wife, but they're not anymore, that's always awkward.
A little bit. The poor chap does not cope well. And he's trying to grasp what's going on and what happened to their past and their marriage. And it was a bit sad, that scene.
Yeah, and he smashes a portrait of them and cuts his hand on a glass. But Rebus isn't much help.
Imagine that.
Yeah, there's a bit later he's, listen, will you just go, please? And then he's like, regrets it and said, oh God, Eleanor, I don't, what am I going to do? What am I going to do? And then there's an awkward hug between him and Rebus.
Mm.
And Rebus's only comment is, don't get blood on the coat. Speaking of coats, this is the debut of the new outfits of the Doom Patrol. These were designed by Brendan McCarthy.
Really?
Yeah. And so the Doom Patrol gets leather jackets and shoulder pads and all this stuff. And Cliff Steele stops running around in like swim trunks with his robot body and starts wearing proper clothes.
That's true. Yeah, I'm just looking at the preceding story arc and that's absolutely correct. They've got their cool new outfits.
Yeah.
There you go.
And Grant Morrison obviously had a hand in this because at this stage, just about every superhero he ever wrote ended up in a leather jacket. You had Zenith and you had Animal Man and now the Doom Patrol.
True, yes.
Yeah, so everyone's wearing coats and they're all looking very hip. Badass.
Cool, as the kids say.
Yeah, except for the sort of peripheral members of the team. So
I can't imagine Joshua's Dorothy. Wearing, or
no, well, Josh. Dorothy is dressed as Dorothy from Wizard of Oz in this, which is a bit of a hint of an upcoming story.
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
I do like how, getting back to this issue, when Cliff and Jane, they're going to visit Rhea in the hospital, only to discover that she's missing. And again, we get more of the chaos coming to the fore in that Jane can kind of sense what's happened and what she needs to do to go and help find Rhea. And her powers manifest, and she's saying she needs to go and find books. She's going crazy, running through the hospital, running across traffic, diving through a glass window of a bookstore, and all the while, Cliff is sort of apologizing to people as they pass by. He's going, it's okay, I'm sorry, she's a superhero, it's okay. Just that absurdness. It's just...
Yeah. Right. And when he exits the shop, he says, and remember, kids, don't walk through plate glass windows.
And Jane's just, she's already gone back to the hospital. She's like, you know, I've got the books I need, you know.
It's a glass embedded in her face.
Yeah, you know, cutting right across traffic and poor Cliff's going, Jane, you know, it's like, it's okay, she's a superhero. But when they get back and they realize they need to try and summon Rhea's location, this was another bit of as far as I know, another example of chaos theory where Jane is ripping pages from the book and cutting them up and casting the shreds in the air. And then somehow they manage to create the incantation she needs to do.
Yeah, I think this is something that William S. Burroughs sort of promoted.
Cut up theory.
Yeah, but from that she gets insights into what's happening.
Mm-hmm. And doesn't she say a lot of gobbledygook?
She does. There's a whole corner of page filled with lots of words.
Oh, yeah.
But her conclusion? The word is murder, old boss.
Mm-hmm.
And she's connected what's happened to Jack the Ripper.
Yes. And then we have a bit of a magic teleportation scene. They open a door. They find an entryway into the French palace we were shown earlier. And they shut the door behind them, and the hospital staff are kind of like, okay, I have to see where they just went. And, of course, the palace has vanished by the time they open the door.
Yeah. That old trick. Of the nurses is a transvestite, I'm convinced.
Really?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
That's a very masculine-looking lady.
Right. Okay. I can kind of see it. But anyway, yes.
I'm not making this up.
People have to read it for sure now to see what we're talking about. We're then shown Cliff wandering through the palace trying to find Jane and Rebus. They're all split up. Lots of weird things are appearing. And that's when we finally see Red Jack holding Rhea.
On the stairs, dripping with water, and he's holding a bloody big knife.
Yes. As you do. Which then leads us into issue 24, also known as The House That Jack Built, which has got one of my all-time favourite covers, with Red Jack standing there with his arms outstretched, and Rebus and Cliff have both been pinned up like butterfly collectors would do so with a butterfly, with the little pins holding their outstretched arms and legs.
Yeah. It's a
bit gross, but I love that cover.
Yeah. It's odd.
Mm.
So into the issue, and we see that Rebus is wandering through a different part of the palace.
Mm-hmm.
And he gets attacked by a giant, bloody creepy puppet.
A marionette from hell.
Yeah. And then we cut to see Jane, and she finds a sort of Victorian-era peep show device and looks through and sees a man sitting naked at a dining table.
And he lifts the cloche up, and it's hands on the plate. And the hands are holding the cutlery, and they... Well, you don't see them, but there's a huge blood splot. And you kind of think, okay, the dinner is eating the man. Of course.
Gross. And there's more weirdness in there, but Jane looks away in disgust and then looks up and sees a giant pair of eyes looking at her through holes.
Ooh.
So it's like peep shows within peep shows. And
peepception.
Creepy as.
Yeah, and then we come back to Cliff, kind of facing off with Red Jack. And, of course, Cliff being Cliff, he wants to know what the hell's going on. And whether or not he can solve it by punching stuff.
Yes.
Because that's how Cliff does. And I love Cliff, but sometimes he's a bit too gung-ho.
He's very direct.
Mm, yes.
Before he can get up the stairs to punch Red Jack, who introduces himself, Red Jack opens up a great big fissure in the ground, a bottomless pit, and Cliff just grabs on just before he plummets.
Yes. That for me, that point is when things are getting really weird, and you kind of know Red Jack's a little bit more powerful than you know, people would expect, or the reader expects, or I expected at least when I first read this. It just got weirder and weirder from this point.
Yes, and he said, "You may be, however, be more familiar with my other title, God. Pleased to meet you."
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay. He's God. He's a butterfly collector. He's kidnapped Rhea, aka Lodestone, who is still in a coma after what happened before Grant Morrison's run started. So I don't think he's quite right in the head.
Yeah. Yes. So what he sort of explains what this place is, and it's like it's endless and it touches all realities,
mm-hmm.
and he wanders through it, and every now and again it touches our reality, and then he comes into our world and does things. And the last time he did this was as Jack the Ripper.
Yes, 100 years earlier he came out and took care of the ladies who walked the streets at night around Whitechapel.
And he said that he was trying to transform them into something new. But
yeah, that's not ever really... That's not explained further what he meant by that, is it?
Just no. That,
you know, he wanted to change their flesh and... here we go, put them into new configurations. But exactly what for? I'm kind of glad it wasn't expanded upon, other than that. Because that's when it gets, a bit more disturbing.
Yeah. Anyway, and Cliff tries to manhandle him and gets smashed, absolutely yes. smashed into a fountain through a staircase. And he's not able to stop Jack from sinking a great big blade into Rhea's back.
Mm. Ouch.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And meanwhile, we cut to Rebus, who's is actually having dual conversations with himself.
Larry and Eleanor are both in there, so
it's not clear who's what or whether. Anyway, but releases the negative spirit, and that's an interesting change because that's the first time that Larry refers to it as a spirit now instead of an energy being.
Yes.
So there's something changing there with Larry, Rebus, Eleanor, whoever. But snap, snap, snap through the Marinette's strings, and Larry wanders out of there.
And then we're back at the fight between Cliff and Red Jack, and Red Jack is just mopping the floor with poor old Cliff.
Yeah.
And of course he's just rambling on with insane stuff about butterflies and what he did on the streets of Whitechapel 100 years ago and.
Yeah, but he's giving the clues. He's saying pain sustains my existence, and that's what he said. Butterflies? Do you like butterflies? So that's the hint, and it's the butterflies that's keeping him alive, their pain.
Again, it's just such a weird. How did Morrison come up with this stuff? Honestly,
I've read enough about Morrison to know he wasn't on drugs when he wrote this.
Really?
Absolutely. No, he swears that. The drugs came later in his career. He was much more involved with drugs around the Invisibles and stuff. But he said the key to understanding Doom Patrol is it's just take it literally.
Right.
Don't look for extra meanings and think it's some sort of mental trick. It's
Right. So hold off until we get to Invisibles for that sort of thing.
Yeah. Not sure if I'm ready for that one.
We'll hold off on the Invisibles podcast just yet. But yes, as is tradition almost in a Doom Patrol issue, Cliff gets an arm ripped off in the middle of combat. Poor bastard.
And Rebus zooms in and gets impaled.
Ouch.
Yeah. So they are very ineffectual in this fight, Rebus and Cliff.
Yes. But thankfully, the negative, quote-unquote, spirit saves the day.
Yep. Disrupts Jack for a few minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And then Cliff gets smashed with a chandelier.
You kind of think, oh, poor Cliff. He's been through so much. And he's had an arm ripped off and a chandelier dropped on top of him. And what else could possibly go wrong? But then Rhea saves the day. Well,
wakes from her coma.
Yeah.
And stabs Jack in the back.
And she's been out of it for, let me see, this is up to issue 24, so like...
5 issues.
5-6 issues. And this is the first thing she does. She just wakes up and saves the day.
Yeah, Rhea's been in a coma since the invasion when the Dominators dropped the gene bomb to take out everyone who had the metagene.
Yes.
And that ended her run of the Doom Patrol at that point.
Pretty much, yeah.
Yeah. But she, stabs Jack and then straight back into a coma.
She had one job. She did it.
And then Jack is sort of attacked by a swarm of butterflies that swirl around him. And they're all free now because Jane's been freeing them.
Yeah, I guess I shouldn't be surprised that all those butterflies in those cases we saw earlier just happened to be alive as well. So, maybe Jack kept them alive but pinned in the cage, in the cupboards, so that he could feed off their pain a bit better. Because as you said, that's what's keeping him alive, feeding off the pain of butterflies. And Morrison wasn't on drugs at all, sure.
No, but as the butterflies are all freed from the pain, Jack just dwindles into nothing.
And yeah.
His clothes collapse, very Wizard of Oz style.
Yeah, and then our heroes, they collect Rhea. Their last scene, wondering how the hell do they get out of there?
Yeah.
They must get out of there somehow, so...
Yeah.
Otherwise, it's a very short run.
Yes, but as they're walking away and talking, we see a butterfly on the floor, probably the same one from the start of the issue, issue 23. And Cliff says, "We never see the things that are right under our noses, do we?" And then steps on it. That's life, I guess.
Yeah. Well said, Cliff. Well said.
Yeah. Now, I happen to have some resources about this. I have a book called Grant Morrison, The Early Years, which was written by Timothy Callahan, mm-hmm. who's a smarter man than I. And he's thought about a lot of the early works from Grant Morrison and done chapters on all the major ones.
Mm-hmm.
And he points out in here that one of the major themes in these two issues are transformation. And it's happening again and again with the butterflies and Red Jack's endeavors with the murdered prostitutes.
Okay.
Yeah, the team getting new outfits.
The team getting new members as well. I mean, Joshua's agreed to stay on. Dorothy's joined them.
Yeah. And the chief has nothing to do with helping them in this, which is something
Yeah.
And he's not even concerned about what they're up to. He's like, oh, they can handle it.
That's true, yeah.
Yeah. But one of the seeds that will come to fruition later is that the butterflies are a metaphor for Rhea. She is beginning a transformation into something else.
This is true. I can't wait till we get to that story.
Yeah, that's a good one, isn't it?
That was one of my favorite ones with Rhea later on. Oh, you guys are going to love that episode. Like you love every other episode, right? Sorry, I wasn't shaking my fist at all. let's move on to issue 25.
What about the epilogue?
Oh, sorry. I was going to keep that a surprise. But yes, let's mention the epilogue.
Epitree.
We basically see, say it's a homeless person walking away from a burning building and saying he didn't do nothing, had nothing to do with it, and that a mysterious figure starts talking to him from the shadows. And this kind of ties back to other epilogues that we've seen in preceding issues.
Yes. Someone's gathering people for some purpose.
Mm. Well, we actually see a villain's name mentioned here.
Yeah.
Who is it, Paul?
Gargwax?
No, it's Mr. Nobody.
Mr. Nobody. Sorry.
Yes. Look, I know you want to do a Gargwax episode, and we will get there one day. But yes, poor old Lloyd Jefferson is wandering away from this burning fire that he apparently had nothing to do with. But then Mr. Nobody has cornered him and says, I welcome you. I've come to set you free. And I welcome you in the name of the Brotherhood.
Yeah. Ooh, Brotherhood. Sounds like
bit of a flashback, maybe. Bit of a link to earlier stories.
Yeah. And I just want to give a special mention to Richard Case for his work in these two issues.
Mm-hmm.
Lots of in buildings and architecture and some really good designs.
Yes.
I imagine it's quite daunting. So you've got to draw chandeliers and fountains and endless corridors and ornate arches and all that.
Mm.
And he does it very well.
Yes. Yes. Okay, so then we launch into issue 25 called Imaginary Friends, which focuses on young Dorothy.
Yes. And it opens with a couple of shoes, red shoes, in a very messy, bloody situation. So blood all over the floor around them and on the wall next to them and everything. I'm going to admit, mate, this isn't one of my favourite issues.
It's not?
It is not.
I like bits of this issue in that the scenes with the chief and Joshua as they're wandering through the headquarters, there's lots of ties back to the Justice League because the complex they're in used to belong to the Justice League. And they're saying that Maxwell Lord has contacted them and he wants something from the trophy room returned.
Yes.
So, it was nice to see there's still some, you know, mainstream DC Universe links still there.
Well, this is before the book was even Vertigo, so there was still mainstream DC Universe at this point. And I actually love the original connections between the very quirky edge of things like Sandman and Doom Patrol and Swamp Thing.
Yes.
And the fact that it could interact, like you could have Batman show up in Swamp Thing and you could have Martian Manhunter show up in Sandman.
Yes.
And the Justice League could show up in Doom Patrol. I really like that because... Yeah. The Doom Patrol works well when it can be, compare them to the other teams and see they're not the same.
Mm. Yes.
Whereas if they're off in the world where everything's weird, then they kind of lose something, I think.
Yeah. When everything and everyone is weird, they're not quite so special anymore.
No.
Well, I mean, they still are, but you know what I mean. Yeah. Anyway, this is Dorothy basically harassing Josh about a TV that's not working. And through conversing with Josh, you learn a bit more about Dorothy's personal history, how she pretty much grew up with imaginary friends.
Yeah, but not like most imaginary friends. They manifest around her.
Yes.
So, and they taught her to read and write. And then, that's pretty weird.
And then when she got fed up with them, she shot them.
How did she shoot them, Mike?
She shot them with an imaginary gun, Paul. What else?
I love that bit. That is actually a really good bit.
And I think by that point, Joshua is getting a little bit concerned about poor old Dorothy.
But yeah.
Who wouldn't be?
Yeah. For the tie into the Justice League is Maxwell Lord, who runs Justice League International at this point,
mm-hmm.
And Justice League Europe, has contacted the chief and said there's something that used to belong to Dr. Destiny, and it's called the Materiopticon, and it basically brings thoughts to life, and it belongs to Dr. Destiny, who you may remember from some things.
I remember... I think it was the same Dr. Destiny that was in Sandman.
It is.
Talking about here. Yeah.
Yeah, and Arkham Asylum.
Okay, yes. Yeah.
Yeah. And there's a really good Dan Jurgens story with Dr. Destiny too.
Okay.
Yeah, anyway. Chief sends Joshua to find this bit of equipment so they can give it back to the Justice League.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but what it does is it takes thoughts and helps them become real.
It's this point in the story where Josh finds the device and the shit hits the fan, pretty much.
Yeah. The ink hits the floor.
The ink hits the floor. The blood-covered red shoes appears on the TV that wasn't working previously. And then Dorothy's imaginary friends, well, family, really, start appearing as well.
Imaginary dad, or imaginary mum, and imaginary baby.
Yeah.
Yeah, get a call back to the Scissorman as Josh was attacked by another scissor-handed monster.
Yes, and then her imaginary family. They, I find them a little bit disturbing. There's the mum, darling, come home. The father, damn all, which I find just hilarious in that a father figure is called damn all, and his suit is basically the financial news and crossword puzzles from the paper. And then there's a baby, Flying Robert, who's like
egg-headed, mono-eyed Cyclops baby thing.
I mean, I get the themes that have been applied to Damn All, the father, and Darling Come Home, the mother, but I don't get...
Yeah, well, none of them look human. They all look bizarre and probably a little bit terrifying.
Yes, that's
a good mouths are way too big, lots of eyes or no eyes, depending on who they are.
Mm.
Pretty disturbing, and they sew up a door... It's pretty messed up. And they want Dorothy to put the shoes on.
Yeah, I think we're getting back into metaphor land here.
Yeah.
Thankfully, Josh comes along and helps rescue... Well, Josh uses his blast powers to open that door up again. Rescues Dorothy, and they manage to escape for a bit. And this is when he starts getting Dorothy to confront what might really be going on.
Yeah, and basically, not to sugarcoat it, it's a metaphor for adolescence and the changes that happen to a young lady.
Yeah, she's basically freaking out and saying everything was going wrong. You know, everything felt it was tearing up inside. She was only 11, and no one told her about the blood. So clearly, a distressing. Incident in her life. I get the impression that Dorothy was literally all alone and trying to deal with, you know, the changes happening in her body and just not coping and having the power to have imaginary friends manifest just didn't help things at all.
Yeah, and there's lots of references to The Wizard of Oz because Dorothy had ruby slippers and There's references to the Hans Christian Andersen fairy tale about the girl who couldn't stop dancing in the red shoes, and
yes.
You know how horrific that was, and how they had to chop her feet off. So it's all, yeah, the shoes and the blood and everything. It's all very awkward.
Awkward and clearly distressing for a young girl.
Yeah.
Clearly, I think that's what's happened is that she's just, you know, not coping with life in general. Her powers aren't helping matters at all, and then this materiopticon device is just accelerating her abilities even worse.
Exacerbating it all.
That's the fancy word I was looking for. Yeah, so again, Josh saves the day by, hey, look, someone punched a device and saved the day. So that was fine. She puts the shoes on. And yeah, they kind of, things calm down after that.
Yeah, and it just ends with Dorothy saying, give me the shoes. And Joshua finds her and she's wearing the shoes. And he says, you put them on, you put on the red shoes. And she says, the ruby slippers, Mr. Clay, they were ruby slippers all along. And just so you hammers it all home, she says, there's no place like home.
Oh.
Ugh. It ends so suddenly. It's like Morrison said, what the hell am I writing? It's time to end this, and does.
I think I like this issue a little bit more than you did.
Yeah, well, it's not my favorite. I just find it incredibly unsubtle.
Like
the metaphor is just spelled out relentlessly all through it, and you know, well, I mean, there's a big tradition of this. There's a really bad Alan Moore Swamp Thing issue about werewolves, which is another metaphor for periods and things. And it's
okay,
just, yeah, that one ain't good either.
Noted. I'll just update my do not read list. We then have another epilogue, this time set in Paris. Didn't we talk about Paris in our last episode, Paul?
We did. Paris has a history with the Doom Patrol. That's where the Brotherhood of Evil were based.
Yes, something about Paris and evil people. Shit, we're going to lose all our listeners in France now, aren't we? Anyway, yes, we have. We have another person essentially being introduced and joining up with the Brotherhood of Evil.
Yeah, and it's spelled out here. And you can't see everybody, but you can see the silhouetted bright light blinding people. And it says, welcome to the Brotherhood of Evil.
Yes. Now, I have to admit, I can't remember which person it is that we are shown in this epilogue. They appear to be talking to themselves Gollum style almost. But I can't remember which power they have.
It's the fog, isn't it?
Oh, possibly.
I think it's the fog.
Okay.
He absorbs people and, yeah, anyway. We'll find out more
about this.
We will
do an episode of it. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
So, yeah, we're kind of, yeah, there's something building up in the background here with the Brotherhood.
Well, I remember reading this issue when it first came out, and when we got to this, I was very excited because, I mean, I hadn't really read a story with the Brotherhood of Evil, but they sounded awesome.
Sweet.
And I knew it was a classic Doom Patrol opponent team, so I was looking forward to that.
Yes.
But, you don't always get what you expect.
No. When we do get to that story eventually, it's going to be quite different from previous Brotherhood stories. Anyway, so in summary, what were your highlights out of these two short stories?
I like the new outfits. I like the team coming together. I like just the variety of powers that Jane has and the way she uses them, like the cut-up divination to work out what's going on. And I like the team are just... You've got Rebus and Robot Man, or Cliff, just trying to bash the problem, and that's not the solution.
No.
Yeah, and the Chief is just so unconcerned about what's going on. So,
he barely appears in either story.
Yeah.
It's pretty much left to the actual active members of the team to deal with what's going on, which was cool.
Yeah, but I mean, I did find these two stories are sort of bridging. Like we had Crawling from the Wreckage, which established the new team. And this is sort of bridging just the team coming together to get to the next storyline, which is one of my favorites.
Yeah, I'd agree. These are basically bridging episodes. I do like that we get to learn a little bit more about the team in these. You know, we see a bit more of what was Eleanor's life before Rebus came along, and we learn a hell of a lot more about Dorothy. So I enjoyed them both.
Yeah, it's good stuff. And I've been quite pleasantly surprised at how readable it is. Like I've read these probably 5 or 6 times already, and to read them again, it's not a chore.
Yeah.
It's quite enjoyable. And I find this with comics. I find rereading comics is much more enjoyable than rereading books, and you can do it more often. It's probably, I don't know what it is. Maybe it's because there's words and pictures. And
I think that's it. And then more often than not, I know for me, there'll be something that I missed the previous time around.
Yeah, and your knowledge of continuity builds up as well, and you're looking at things through a new lens constantly because you know more about the characters from things you've read in the past and, you know, in their past and in their future as far as the order of things you read. It's, I really enjoy rereading comics.
Yeah. Good stuff.
Excellent.
Okay. Well, that's pretty much Doom's planning for this week. Let's move on to the Mailbag of Doom.
Okay, welcome to the Mailbag of Doom. This week we got some interesting mail. We heard from Reggie, who's at Reggie, and he was listening to our previous episode, for those not in the know. And he said, "Esteemed fellows of the WFD pod, Giacomo is pronounced Giacomo and is Italian form of Jacob. Great episode, though. So I am learning things all over the place here."
See, look. We're sharing our love and knowledge of the Doom Patrol. Our listeners are sharing their love and knowledge of stuff that they know and love.
Of words.
Yeah.
And names.
That'll do.
Yeah. Oh, so I'm improving myself constantly.
Yeah.
Paramecium, Giacomo. I'm learning all sorts of things.
What was the question of the week, Paul?
This week's question was, what's the most unsettling comic you've read? And we heard from Dr. Ange.
Dr. Ange. You know what? He is the man.
Love Dr. Ange.
Love him.
Actually, if you're not following Dr. Ange on Twitter, Dr. Ange70, I recommend you do. He is a top person to interact with, knows heaps about comics going way back, and it's quite amusing.
Yes. Big Supergirl fan too. I love
Massive
his
Supergirl.
Love for the Supergirl stuff that's happening with the TV show coming up.
Yeah.
It's going to be his year. Yeah, oh, hell yeah. What did the good doctor say?
He said, two unsettling comics. Ooh. Miracle Man 15 or Hellblazer 12.
Okay.
Have you read either of these?
I've never read any Miracle Man. I've read some early Hellblazer. I don't think I've read this issue that he's talking about, though.
Okay, I know of the Miracle Man issue, and but I have read and I own this Hellblazer issue. So anyway, he gave us a little description. Said, so the Miracle Man one is, Kid Miracle Man's assault on London is horrifying. Raining limbs down, skinning people, and hanging them in a laundry line, etc. That does sound horrific. And that is an issue that I know by reputation.
Wow.
And I am actually in the process of finally reading Miracle Man.
Okay.
And as soon as the library gets the next volume, I will read that story. So looking forward to that. Anyway, but he goes on, but Astra's story from the Norfolk thing in Newcastle is terrifying. And I have to agree with that. This is a story that Jamie Delano finally told, but it was set up in Swamp Thing with John Constantine's background. So basically there was something horrific happened to John Constantine, put him into a mental institution. And this is that story, and it's basically an exorcism gone horribly wrong.
Oh dear.
Yeah. So you know, arrogance and hubris costing the lives of an innocent, and it really is quite horrific.
Okay.
Yeah.
Wow.
Not one to read to your kids.
Noted. We also heard from Shmoby1, who is at Shmoby1 on Twitter, and he said Green Lantern 54, and I remember this issue as well, because it's the infamous Women in Refrigerators issue. It's got to be up there in terms of unsettling comics. That was pretty disturbing.
Yeah.
When Kyle Rayner discovers what a certain villain has done with his girlfriend at the time. That was pretty dark.
It was pretty dark, particularly because it's in a sort of mainstream superhero comic, so
exactly.
You don't really expect it.
Yeah.
You know, Swamp Thing, you expect things like that, but...
Mm.
We heard from Dasquire, who's spelled Daskwire, which is a cool way to spell Dasquire. It's a new one for us. He said, Preacher, love Steve Dillon's artwork, but that was some twisted shit.
And I will be coattailing on Desquire's answer, because that is also my answer for this week. I loved Preacher, but holy geez, there was some messed up stuff in that series. Messed up.
I honestly just can't Preacher.
You can't Preacher?
I can't. I've read it, but I'm really so uncomfortable with it.
Yeah, it's one of my all-time favorite series. It's one of those series where, when I've moved house over the years and, you know, I've sort of given stuff away and or sold books off to a comic store or, you know, had to cull down so I can move with a bit more ease, Preacher is one of the few series that I've never let go of. I love it that much. But by the same token, there are things in there that are horrifying and disgusting and just completely wrong.
Yeah. And it's not, I mean, if you have a certain level of faith, it's actually quite a confronting book as well.
That too, yes.
Yeah.
Agreed, so.
Mm.
Yes. We also heard from Neon Genesis Panderson.
Panderson Art,
who said, From Hell, without a doubt. I've never read From Hell.
I've read From Hell.
That was a film, wasn't it?
It was a film. It was a pretty woeful... Well, it's not a very good adaptation of a very, very, very complex and dense story. But Alan Moore and... Who's the artist? That Aussie bloke with the Scottish accent. Anyway, we're good for this sort of stuff. he gets into a great deal of detail about, you know, each and every murder by Jack the Ripper. And,
right.
Yeah, it's not for the squeamish.
Okay.
Yeah. Anyway, we heard from Reggie again.
Again?
Oh, again.
He loves us.
Unstoppable. And he said probably a reprint of an issue of Zap Comics from the 60s. And I was like, what's Zap Comics from the 60s? But that was the underground comics in the late 60s where Robert Crumb sort of came to prominence.
Oh.
So lots of bug-eyed people, lots of naked men doodity, lots of... crazy steam coming out of the ears and everything.
Did you just invent the word dudity? Is that like dudes?
No, I think I heard the word dudity around the time of 300 coming out. So
that is brilliant. Wow, dudity.
Yeah. So there's a lot of weirdness in from the covers I've seen and everything. And, you know, it all looks like that sort of crazy, you know, faces distorted and steam coming out of ears sort of stuff. So I could see how that could be disturbing at the wrong age.
Yeah. We also heard from Richie O'Hara-Beeman, who is at Rickety OB on the Twitters.
Hey, Rickety!
Hey, Rickety. He said, as an innocent hope-filled kid, Martial Law was the unsettling comic he read. Kingdom of the Blind was quite the shock. A misjudged gift from family, he thinks.
Wow. So I've never read any Martial Law.
I've not read any, no.
I'm familiar with the Kevin O'Neill look and feel of it. Kevin went on to do A League of Extraordinary Gentlemen with Alan Moore.
Okay.
Yeah.
So sort of staying within that circle of unsettling.
Yeah, creators. I think it's quite violent, I believe. Very violent. Mm. Anyway.
Okay.
We heard from Matt Roberts, Mr. Oberts. He said, From Hell, that shit is crazy. And I wrote it. Now, this is... Matt is delusional that he is Alan Moore some of the time.
When he's not being a young rapper called Matty B.
Matty B.
he's got lots of different alter egos going on there.
Matt be cray cray, that's what I say.
For reals. I mean, for reals. we heard from good friend of the show, Aaron Long at Juice005, and he said, Doom Patrol. Most definitely Doom Patrol.
Thanks, Aaron.
I don't know if he's fucking troll.
It's classic Aaron.
That's classic juice. Anyway.
We heard from Mike Lapine, or Lapine is me. And he said, any issue of Crossed, I've happened to flip through most Avatar press books. And he added, Heroes Reborn Captain America. Different type of unsettling. But, Crossed is all that zombies and crucifixes stuff, isn't it?
As far as I know, I've never heard a little bit about it. Yeah.
Yeah, I went, oh, Garth Ennis. And then I read it and went, oh, Garth Ennis.
What's your most unsettling comic that you've read, Paul?
Oh, we have a late entry in the answer.
We do. Oh, my apologies.
Okay, so we heard from Rift 1821.
Good old
And
Rift.
He said, the issue of the Ultimates when the US government shoots Hawkeye, his wife, and infant daughter. Very disturbing stuff. Now, that's Ultimates 2, issue 7, I believe.
Okay.
Yeah. You read that?
I avoided any Ultimates book, to be honest. I read the first Ultimate Spider-Man. Trade, and then was like, no.
I'm a big booster for Mark Miller's work on Ultimates 1 and 2, and okay. I have the gorgeous oversized hardcovers of those. Ooh. And they are bloody great, and I don't think we'd have the Marvel movies as they stand now without those books existing.
Wow.
But yeah, it's a very... Hawkeye in that is very Matrix, like leather-clad guns and stuff, and bows and arrows and stuff. It's yeah... But their big mistake is letting him live. It's that sort of story.
Okay.
Yeah. So, yes, my answer, it actually harkens back. We were talking about Dr. Destiny earlier,
mm-hmm.
and you mentioned the Sandman. There's a Sandman issue, number 6.
Yes.
Called 24 Hours.
Oh, yes.
Which is Dr. Destiny in a diner, and he has mind control powers, and he is insane, and... what he does to the people in that diner over the course of 24 hours is messed up.
That's true story. That was the first issue of Sandman I ever read.
Wow.
And I was about 14 or 15 at the time. So, you know.
Yeah. I think people forget. I mean, people are so used to Sandman now that, and, you know, the gothy coolness of it, that they forget how horrific it could be at times.
Yeah. Some of those early ones, especially, yeah, when he was getting all his equipment back after being locked away for so long. Yeah.
Yeah.
But, that's a great choice, Paul. Great
yeah,
choice.
That is a scary comic.
Mm.
Unsettling. I mean, I don't lie awake worrying about it, but, you know, some of the stuff that happens in that one.
Yeah.
Eat bits of each other, and there's knitting needles in eyes and also,
there's confessions enough. About what people do to each other in prison, and yeah, it was.
Yeah.
Wow.
Oh. Messed up. What about you, Mike?
I'll stick with Preacher. Yeah, Preacher as a series, that some of the stuff in that was, yeah, quite unsettling.
Yeah.
But I still love it, and I will never let that series go from my collection, so, yeah.
Can I have that from your collection, Mike?
We will talk after the show, and no.
Anyway, you're right.
That's pretty much it for our show this week. What are we going to be talking about on our next show, Paul?
I think it's time to look at some of the early Kupperberg stuff. So Paul Kupperberg wrote Doom Patrol. In fact, he reintroduced the team in the 70s after they hadn't been around since the 60s.
Mm.
And, there's a few... issues here and there that you and I could piece together that happened between volumes 1 and 2, and we're going to look at those.
Yeah. It's kind of like Doom Patrol, the lost years.
Yeah, a lot of people wouldn't have read these, I reckon. Oh. Yeah, and I certainly hadn't read them until a little while ago.
Excellent. I can't wait to talk about that, because some of those Kupperberg ones are my favourite issues that like aren't in the mainstream series. If you, dear listener, want to reach us before the next episode, you can get to us at Twitter, at WFDpod. You can email us at waitingfordoom@gmail.com. And we've also got the Waiting for Doom Facebook page. Any other parting thoughts? Any parting thoughts for us this week, Paul?
No, I wish I had something witty to say, but I'm out.
We started so witty at the start, and it's late now. We're all tapped out.
The wit pool is run dry. The wit bucket empty.
We are witless. Man, that's pretty harsh. Thanks for listening, guys. We will see you again next week.
Bye-bye.